This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello. 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17. Blast off. These are prime numbers. I could continue, but we could be here for some time. Infinity. The most likely result of that sequence of numbers, which we were speaking about today, literally would go on forever. Last month, a team of researchers in Missouri successfully calculated the highest, latest prime number, and it is 9.1 million digits. For nearly 2,500 years since Euclid first described the prime numbers in his book Elements, mathematicians have struggled to write a rule to predict what comes next in the sequence. The Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler feared that it's a mystery into which the human mind will never penetrate, but others have been more hopeful. In the middle of the 19th century, the German mathematician Bernhard Riemann discovered a connection between prime numbers and a complex mathematical function called the zeta function. Ever since, mathematicians have labored to prove the existence of this connection and reveal the rules behind the elusive sequence. What exactly are prime numbers, and what secrets might they unlock about our understanding of atoms? What are the rules that may govern the prime sequence? And is it possible that the person who proves Riemann's hypothesis may bring about the collapse of the world's financial system? With me to discuss prime numbers are Marcus du Sautoy, Professor of Mathematics and Fellow of Wadham College at the University of Oxford, Robin Wilson, Professor of Pure Mathematics at the Open University and Gresham Professor of Geometry, and Jackie Steddle, Junior Research Fellow in the History of Mathematics at Queen's College, Oxford. Marcus du Sautoy, what are prime numbers and what is their significance?
Prime numbers, probably everybody remembers from school, are these numbers which are not divisible by anything. So you can't divide them, a number like 17, I can't write as two smaller numbers multiplied together. But 15, for example, I can write as 3 times 5, so that's not a prime number. Why they're so important to me as a mathematician are that they're the building blocks of all numbers. So if you take any number, it can be built by multiplying these prime numbers together. So a number like 105 is built by multiplying 3 times 5 times 7. So the primes are a little bit like the atoms of arithmetic. They're the sort of hydrogen and oxygen of the world of mathematics. And that's why they're so important to the mathematician, because they're a little bit like the periodic table for a mathematician. The periodic table in chemistry lists 109 chemical elements from which you can build all molecules. Well, the primes, 2, 3, 5 and 7, they're like the hydrogen, helium and lithium of the world of mathematics.
So their significance is to mathematicians in order to further their progress as mathematicians, mostly.
Yes, we're constantly finding we're having to go back to understanding the primes, because primes build numbers, from numbers you get mathematics, from mathematics you get the whole of science. So in a sense, they're right down there at the bedrock of our subject. So quite often, a mathematician will be exploring a subject, will find they'll need to know things about the primes in order to make progress. I mean, I've got lots of theorems which depend on certain properties of the primes being true in order to be able to prove them.
Can you tell us about the occurrence of prime numbers in the natural world?
Yeah, that's very interesting. In fact, mathematicians weren't the first to discover the importance of the primes. It was, in fact, a curious little insect in the forest in North America. It's a cicada. It has a very strange life cycle. This cicada hides underground for 17 years, a prime number, doing absolutely nothing. Then after 17 years, these cicadas emerge en masse into the forest and sort of party away. They sing, they eat the leaves, they have sex, they lay eggs. And then after 6 weeks of partying, the forest is so loud that the residents in North America have to move out. But after 6 weeks, they all die, and the forest goes quiet again for another 17 years. So is it just a coincidence that it's 17 that they're hiding underground? Well, it seems not. There's another species which hides underground for 13 years and another for 7 years.
So two more prime numbers.
Two more prime numbers, exactly. So what is it about the primes that are helping these cicadas? Well, we're not too sure, actually, but we have a hypothesis.
Just a second, we didn't get that quite clear. Yeah. These things will get the cicadas if they come out at the wrong time.
Well, this is what we think. There might be a predator in the forest that also appears periodically. Now, if the predator chooses, say, 6 years for every time it appears, then the cicada that appears every 7 years will keep out of sync much more often than a cicada that appears every 8 years, for example, or every 9 years. But the cicada that appears every 7 years will meet the predator for the first time in year 42. 42 is 6 times 7. But the cicada, who appears every 9 years, for example, well, in year 18, both the predator and the cicada are there in the forest, both divisible by 6 and 9. So it seems like the primes were literally the key to the evolutionary survival of these cicadas, that those that chose a non-prime number year were knocked out because they kept on getting in sync with the predator.
Have there been any, briefly, have there been any more discoveries of prime numbers in evolutionary development in various other species?
Well, that's the best one I know. I mean, I think another interesting example is actually in music, which uses the same sort of idea. I mean, Messiaen used this idea of primes keeping you out of sync in the Quartet for the End of Time. He has two instruments, one which has a 17-note sequence and another one with a 29-note sequence. And because they keep on interlocking in different ways through the piece, you get this sense of timelessness through the piece. So primes are very good because they don't get you in sync with something. So
before we get back to the European development, the Chinese, ancient Chinese, spotted the primes a long time ago, didn't they?
Yes, they had a very geometrical way of looking at primes, actually. They like to think of, I mean, primes, if you take a number of stones, and if it's a prime number of stones, say 17, there's not a very nice way to lay it out in a geometric rectangle, whilst 15 stones I can lay out as 3 rows of 5. And they actually translated this into a sort of personal characteristic of the primes. They used to think that each number had a sort of sexuality. So even numbers were female, male numbers, odd numbers were male, but the really macho numbers in the Chinese sort of mythology were the primes, because you couldn't break those down. 15 you could lay out as 3 rows of 5 stones, but 17 stones, there was no way to break this down. So that's a kind of nice physical way of seeing the primes, that if you take a prime number of stones, you can't arrange them into a nice rectangle.
Robin Wilson, in the 3rd century BC, we come to the great Greek mathematician Euclid, and he made 2 groundbreaking discoveries about prime numbers. Can you tell us about the first of these?
Yes, the most important thing that Euclid did in his Elements, which of course is probably the most important mathematics book of all time, which was used constantly for about 2,000 years, is largely a book about geometry, but in the middle of it there's a whole section about numbers, and in the books 7 to 9, for example, he talks about odd numbers, even numbers, prime numbers, and perfect numbers, which we'll come on to later. And talking about prime numbers, his most important statement was to prove that there are infinitely many primes. In other words, if you try to write out a list of all the primes, as you said earlier, you have to go on forever. There aren't just a finite number of them.
How did he prove that, Rob?
It was very, very ingenious, and in fact I think mathematicians regard it as probably one of the most beautiful proofs in the whole of mathematics. The idea is to do it by contradiction. You assume that there are only a finite number of primes, and then show that from that finite number of primes, in fact, you can construct another one. And the way he did it is, supposing you only knew that the primes 2, 3, and 5, okay? If you multiply them together and then add 1, you get 31, which is another prime. If you take 2 and 3 and 5 and 7 and multiply them together and add 1, you get 211, which is another prime. So it seems as though you always get another prime. You've got to be slightly careful, because sometimes you don't get a prime. If you take all the primes up to 13 and add them together, you get 30,000. And add 1, you get 30,031, which looks like a prime, but in fact it's 59 times 509. But the point is, if you assume there are only a finite number of them, and you multiply them together and then add 1, your new number will not be divisible by any of the primes in your list. Therefore, there must be at least one other prime in the list.
Therefore, they must be infinite.
And therefore, each time you've got to find a number, there's another one, and therefore they must be infinite, yes.
And the other law he laid down was to do with the creation of even numbers, wasn't it? That primes added up to all even numbers came out of primes.
No, that's not Euclid. That's a result called Goldbach's conjecture.
I'm getting ahead of myself, and I'm showing my ignorance. Perfectly all right. Thank you for correcting me there.
But we should come on to that later on.
Yeah. How did he discover that the primes? You've talked about building blocks. You've talked about atoms. How did he come to that conclusion then?
Well, it's sometimes been said that Euclid's Elements contains the statement that every number can be broken down into its factors. Whether that's quite clear in Euclid is not sure. In fact, I think the first real proof of it was somewhat later. But it certainly in the folklore of the time, in Greek time, that every number can be, not only can be split into primes, but can be done so in only one way. So if you've got 12, it's only two twos and a three, just like with a chemical analogy, water has to be two hydrogens and one oxygen. And incidentally, one of the consequences of that is that we don't normally take one to be a prime, because if you have this basic rule, every number breaks down into primes in only one way, and if you allowed one to be a prime, then you're in trouble, because you've got three is the same as three times one, is the same as three times one, and so on. So it splits into primes in many different ways. The only way out of that, if you want to keep that result, is to say one cannot be a prime.
Jackie Settle, Euclid made his discoveries about prime numbers while looking for perfect numbers. Why were the Greeks interested in perfect numbers?
Well, perhaps I should explain what a perfect number is. A perfect number is one where you can take all its divisors or factors and add them together and you get back to the number you started with. For instance, 6 is the simplest one probably. 6 divides by 1, by 2, by 3. If you add 1 and 2 and 3 together, you get back to 6. The next perfect number is 28, with divisors 1, 2, 4, 7, 14. Again, if you add those together, you get back to 28. Now, these are very special numbers, and they're quite rare. This is a very special property. And for some reason, people were interested in perfect numbers and how to find them. And it comes about that you can find perfect numbers if you can find a particular kind of prime first. And to find those special primes, you have to take what I might call the 2 series. You start from 2 and you double it to get 4, double again to get 8, double again to get 16, and so on. You look at those numbers in the 2 series. If you can find a prime by subtracting 1 from one of them, that will lead you to a perfect number. Now, Euclid knew this. I don't know how he knew it, but he knew this, that you can use these particular primes to build perfect numbers.
Was the allure of perfect numbers outside the interest in mathematical development at the time?
For the Greeks, I don't know. Later in early Christian theology, the perfect numbers came to have almost a kind of mystical significance. They were associated with the virtues because they're rare and they're few and far between, whereas the ordinary numbers around them were associated with vices, and there are plenty of those and plenty of different ones. So they came to have a kind of religious significance for Christian writers.
Was there any feeling, Robin has talked about Euclid, when Euclid was doing these, making these discoveries, that these were useful? Or are we talking about intellectual endeavour for its own sake?
I think we're talking about intellectual endeavour for its own sake. There wouldn't have been at the time any use for these things at all.
There's another Greek mathematician, if I can pronounce him, Eratosthenes,
yes.
Devised a remarkably neat theory. For listing prime numbers.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
It's not really a theory, it's a method, and it's nice and simple. Eratosthenes lived slightly later than Euclid. He was the librarian at Alexandria, and also known as a geographer. He was one of the people who first made an estimate for the circumference of the Earth. But also he looked at prime numbers and said you can find the prime numbers by eliminating other numbers, if you like. So if you make a list of your numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then you go along your list and you cross out everything that's divisible by 2. You cross out all the even numbers. And then you go along and cross out everything that's divisible by 3, and then everything that's divisible by 5. And when you've done that, what you've got left are prime numbers. So it's like a sieve. It's called the sieve of Eratosthenes. You sieve out all the numbers that have some factors, and what you're left with in your net are the primes.
So we have this interest in prime numbers and perfect numbers. Let's stick with prime numbers.
Yeah.
It's as much as I can get my head around prime numbers. With the Greeks, why were they so interested? Because we're about to come to more or less a big gap, aren't we? So why were they so interested, do you think?
We don't really know. The Greeks were the first people to really think about numbers in an abstract way. I mean, people have always calculated, they've always done things with numbers, but the Greeks actually started thinking about numbers in an abstract way and what kinds of numbers you can have. As Robin said, even, odd, square numbers, perfect numbers, prime numbers. They were interested in these classifications of numbers.
Marcus Esoetoi, and then for about 2,000 years, Boethius sort of carried through the ideas of Euclid as he understand it, but there wasn't a great deal of interest in prime numbers until the 17th century when you have two Frenchmen turning. Why the gap, first of all? Why the lack of loss of interest?
I don't think it's so much a loss of interest, but a lack of tools. I think we really had to wait, and we'll see this over the discussion. Each generation brought a new sort of mathematics and a new way of looking at things, which gave people new tools to be able to talk about these numbers. I mean, the point about these numbers, there's this infinite list of numbers, but, you know, a mathematician at heart, what we do is we're pattern searchers. Well, if you look at a sequence of these prime numbers, there don't seem to be any patterns to them at all. They seem extremely random. And so for, I think those two millennia spent sort of seeing that there are no patterns and just not knowing quite what to do.
Does the fact that they're infinite mean that you can't have a pattern because there isn't anything closed at the end?
No, you can have a pattern for infinite sequences of
really?
Numbers. For example, odd numbers. I know how to get all the odd numbers. I just keep on adding two each time. That's a very generative pattern. I mean, this is why this you mentioned this news story of the discovery of a 9.1 million digit prime. I mean, why is this news? You know, nobody make the news of discovering a 9.1 million digit odd number. I mean, the point is that they're so difficult to find. We know there are infinitely many of them, but how do we find them? I mean, Robin's already pointed out that Euclid's proof doesn't actually help you to find primes. It just shows you that they don't run out. And this is what happened, I think, in the sort of 17th century, is that suddenly the age of equations came, when people understood that equations were quite good ways of generating sequences of numbers. So that's why we get somebody like Mersenne, who's a French monk who was quite obsessed with numbers, also obsessed with music. He came up with a theory of harmonics. And he actually took these numbers that Jackie's already mentioned, where you multiply two together a lot of times, take one off that number, and perhaps you'll get a prime that way. And these numbers are now called Mersenne primes, after Mersenne's sort of discovery that this seemed quite a good way to construct primes. And in fact, this discovery of the 9.1 million digit number that is a prime of this shape. You have to multiply two together, I think, about 30 million times or something, and then take one off that number. So this seemed to be quite a good way to generate primes, but it doesn't always give you a prime. Fermat also came up with a way of generating primes. He multiplied two together a lot of times and added one. So we come to an age when people were starting to explore the power of equations to actually find the primes for you.
Robin Wilson, it was in the 18th century, the Swiss mathematician Leonard Euler, who first proved a link, as I understand it, which came to be known as the zeta function, between the link between the zeta function and prime numbers. Now, can you tell me, please, what the zeta function is and what the link is?
It's rather technical. I'll try and make it as simple as I can. There was an outstanding problem which no one could solve, and it was to do with adding the reciprocals of the squares of the numbers. Now, what this means, the counting numbers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. Their squares are 1, 4, 9, 16, and so on. The reciprocals of these are 1, a quarter, a ninth, a 16th, a 25th, and so on.
Fractions. Are sort of
they're
like
all the fractions, yeah. Yes. Reciprocal means 1 over. Mm. Okay. Now, if you add them all together, it was known that they added together to give an actual number, somewhere around 1.6. But no one could actually work out what that number was until Euler came along. And then he did two amazing things. The first was that, using rather dubious mathematics, he actually came up with the right answer. He showed that the sum of that series, the sum of the 1 over these squares of these of the natural numbers, is the number pi squared over 6. Now, pi is the circle number. It's the ratio of the circumference of a circle to the diameter. Why should pi come in with the sum of the series?
You'll have to tell me.
Well, as I say, it was all highly mysterious, okay? But the other thing that he did was he linked what we've been talking about, which has nothing to do with primes, he linked it very, very strongly with the primes. And the link with the primes is as follows. We're talking about the squares of the numbers. So if you take, for example, 2 and square, 2 squared, let's divide that by 1 less, so that's 4 over 3. Okay. Take the next prime number, 3 squared, subtract 1, 8. So let's look at 9 over 8. Next prime, 25, square it, you get 25 over 24. So if you take the product of all of these things, you take 4 over 3, 9 over 8, 25 over 24. If you keep on sort of taking the square of a prime and divide it by one less and multiply them all together, amazingly, you get the same thing. You get pi squared over 6. He got a direct link between that, the original sum we were talking about, where you're adding together the reciprocals of the squares and the prime numbers. And that was completely unsuspected. Why should there be a link between the first problem, which had nothing to do with primes, but generally very closely involved with the primes?
Well, why?
That's what he proved. And it actually, I won't go into the details, but it all boils down to the fact that every number can be written as a product of primes. So, for example, if you have one of the numbers in this, like 1 over 60, you can think of it as 1 over 2 squared times 1 over 3 times 1 over 5. And when you multiply a whole lot of things together, that's where all these terms come from. Anyway, the crucial thing is that, first of all, he took a problem which seemed to have nothing to do with primes, and he linked it with primes, and then he extended it. We've been talking about adding 1 over the squares. He did a similar thing for the fourth powers. And there he got added them all together, and he got something like pi to the fourth over 90. Now, Euler was not shy of doing hard work, so he did it for the sixth powers, the eighth powers. He went up to the 26th powers. And then from this, he then introduced what you mentioned, the zeta function, which is rather crucial. So what he did was he said, okay, go back to our original problem. You're squaring numbers, you're taking one over them, adding them together. We'll call that zeta of 2. Okay, the next one is you're taking the fourth powers, taking one over them, adding them together. We'll call that zeta of 4. And in general, if you take all the natural numbers, all the whole numbers, and raise them to any power, say the kth power, and add them together, you call it zeta of k. So what he produced out of this was a thing called the zeta function, which arose directly out of adding together all those fractions. But as we've seen, he also linked it very, very closely with the primes.
Does that, Jackie Stedall, did that take the, obviously it took the study forward, and in the 19th century Germany became the major European mathematical centre, and we arrive at Friedrich Gauss. What part did he take up what had been discovered by Euler?
No, he didn't actually. He moved off on a slightly different tack. Gauss was a child prodigy, really. He was a terrific calculator, even as a child, very interested in mathematics and in numbers and calculation. And as a young boy at school, he had a table of prime numbers and simply spent a lot of time looking at these numbers and trying to see some sort of pattern in them. And what he did was counting primes, really. He looked at how many primes you have in the first 100 numbers, say, how many you have in the next 100, how many you have in the first 1,000. And what you discover is that as you go through higher and higher numbers, the primes begin to thin out a bit. They become less dense as you go further on. There are always infinitely many of them. You'll always find another one. But it takes you longer, on average, to find the next one. So that was his discovery. And he was able to be a bit more precise than that. He was able to give an estimate for what we might call the density of primes at any point. So if you look at the numbers around a million, for instance, he found that the density of primes is 1 over the logarithm of a million. This is something he discovered by simply looking and calculating. And I think we don't often think of mathematics as an experimental subject, but just as with Euler, a lot of mathematics is done by pure calculation, pure slog, lots and lots of hard work, looking at the patterns that emerge, making a hypothesis, testing it out.
So we're not yet in the business of Gauss taking up Euler, who took up...
This is a rule of thumb.
Did they know each other's work then?
Gauss would certainly have read Euler's work, yes. I'm sure, but didn't take up this particular thing of the zeta function that Robin explained.
Marcus Sotoy Riemann was Gauss's pupil, and he made an enormous contribution, as I understand it.
Definitely. And I think he almost made it by chance. I mean, experimental work is very important in mathematics, and also being lucky, I think, is as well. And I think I don't think anyone expected this zeta function to really be as helpful it is as it has been in understanding the primes. And I think a model of what Gauss discovered is to say that the primes, they look very random. So it looks like they've that nature chose them by some sort of throwing a dice and sort of deciding at each throw whether a number is prime or not. I mean, obviously you can't make a prime not a prime by throwing a dice, but it produces quite a good model for the way the primes look. And what Gauss discovered was that there are 25 primes less than 100. So that means there's a 1 in 4 chance that a number from 1 to 100 is a prime. So nature is using a sort of four-sided dice to choose primes up to 100. When you get to 1,000, they've thinned out a bit more. There's only 1 in 6 chance that a number is prime. So it looks like nature's now used a six-sided dice, say with 5 sides blank and 1 side with a P on it, which says prime. And so you throw the dice and you find that you get 1 in 6 numbers randomly distributed, and that looks rather like the primes. So Gauss discovered how the number of sides on the dice is growing as you count higher and higher through the universe of numbers. So they thin out, so the number of sides on the dice is growing and growing. So that gave him a way to estimate how many primes you'll expect to see as you count further and further through the universe of numbers. This is actually called the prime number conjecture, was proved 100 years later by Hadamard and Delevalle-Poussin. Mathematicians, though, do not like inexact things. We're obsessed with things being precise and exact. So Gauss has got us a good first guess at roughly how many primes there are as you count higher and higher. But mathematicians want to know exactly how that prime number dice landed and know precisely how many primes there are. And this is what Riemann discovered. His use of the zeta function enabled him to understand, in a sense, how that prime number dice landed. And he discovered this almost by chance. He was working on this function, the Riemann zeta function. Actually, it wasn't called the Riemann zeta function then, of course. It was just called the zeta function. But and you can think of this function. Robin's already alluded to the fact that you take a, you put in a number, you raise some, you do a little calculation. Perhaps don't worry what that calculation is, and you get out an answer. Feed in 2, do some calculation, out comes pi squared over 6. So this is what a function is. You feed in numbers, and it's like a little calculating program, and it outputs answers. He took some new sort of numbers that were on the mathematical block at the time, which were called imaginary or complex numbers. Now, these are sort of like two-dimensional numbers. They came out of trying to solve equations like, what's the square root of minus 1? Well, most of us don't know any numbers whose squares are minus 1. At that sort of time in mathematics, we decided to invent a new number called an imaginary number, which could solve that equation. And because there's no room on the number line, I mean, we have this sense of the number line, positive numbers going off to sort of to the east, negative numbers to the west. Gauss actually produced this picture of these imaginary numbers as sort of two-dimensional numbers. So you go north if you want to have an imaginary number. So we've got this sort of new landscape of numbers, which are sort of two-dimensional, sort of an east-west direction, which is the one we sort of understand, normal numbers. But now we have a north-south direction, which are these new imaginary numbers, which were being looked at the time. Riemann took these new numbers and said, what happens if we feed them into the zeta function? And amazingly, he got a sort of, you can think of, most people probably know what a graph is. If you feed in numbers, the height of the graph tells you the answer to that function. Well, he produced a three-dimensional graph. You feed in these two-dimensional numbers into the zeta function, out pops a number, and then that's the height of this landscape.
Jackie Steddall, can you tell us then how this developed into what we now know as the Riemann hypothesis?
Yes, well, in exploring this three-dimensional landscape that Marcus is talking about, you look at it and it has mountains and valleys. It's like looking at a piece of land, really. It never dips below sea level, but sometimes it goes down to sea level. And what Riemann was interested in were the points where it dips to sea level. It goes right down to zero. The height of the land goes down to zero. This only happens at isolated points. But what he discovered when he calculated some of these points was that they all lay beautifully on a straight line. It's a north-south line in Marcus's description. And the real part, in each case, the real part of the number where the zero happens is a half. It's exactly a half. So the imaginary part can be anything you like, but the real part always seems to be exactly a half, which makes the numbers lie on this lovely straight line, this north-south line. So Riemann's hypothesis was that all the zeros are going to lie on this line. He couldn't prove it. It was he did a lot of calculation. We now know that he did more calculation in his rough notes than he ever published. Again, lots of calculation. But his hypothesis was that this was always going to happen.
I mean, these zeros are so important for this landscape because they're a little bit Riemann discovered that they're the DNA of these imaginary complex landscapes. So in a sense, if you know where this landscape falls to sea level, it tells you everything else about the landscape. I mean, it's like from that DNA, you can generate the rest of the landscape. That's why these points at sea level, these zeros, where the function output zero are so important. It builds the landscape. Now, what does that have to do with primes? Well, primes also help to build that landscape. As Robin described, the function that you use to build the Riemann zeta function is also built out of primes. And this is Riemann's amazing discovery that, well, there must be a link between these two things. If they both build the same thing, this beautiful complex landscape, the zeros are the DNA of this thing, but the primes are built the function that generated it, there must be a link between the two. And that's Riemann's great discovery.
Robin, do you want to add to that?
Yes, I wanted to sort of say how it actually carried on, because I'd like to introduce the English mathematician G.H. Hardy.
Yeah.
Hardy was probably the greatest English mathematician of the first half of the 20th century. And he was famous both for the huge amount of work he did in prime numbers and other things, and also with his great collaborators. He collaborated with the Indian genius Ramanujan, and also with the mathematician Littlewood, and between them they produce a huge amount of material on prime numbers and other things. And Hardy in particular got interested in the Riemann hypothesis. As Jackie said, the hypothesis is, do all these zeros, these dips in the landscape, do they all occur on a north-south line? And Hardy showed that, in fact, infinitely many of them do. That if you look at this line, you'll find the first zero at 14.1 or something, and the next one at 20 or something, and the next one at 20-something. And they occur from time to time, but they're in fact that there are infinitely many of them on the line. This doesn't mean that you've got all of them, because, of course, the fact you've got infinitely many of them may mean that you have a few which are not on the line, or you may have infinitely many not on the line. But he showed that in fact that infinitely many of them are on the line. So that gave good support to the hypothesis, and the person he worked with, Littlewood, the two of them, it was probably the best, greatest mathematics partnership of all time. I mean, they wrote so many papers together. In fact, it was even said at the time that there were three great mathematicians from Britain. One was Hardy, second was Littlewood, and third was Hardy-Littlewood. And Littlewood also looked at the Riemann hypothesis, and he showed that at least a third of all the zeros lie on the line. It's very crucial. The whole Riemann hypothesis is that they all do. But in mathematics, if just one failed to, then the whole thing has gone out the window. In mathematics, proof is absolute. Everything has to work. In science, there might be experimental error, there might be one or two things which don't go right, but in mathematics, proof is absolute. And just a single prime not on that line, a single zero not on that line, basically throws the whole thing out the window.
I think we perhaps should say what the Riemann hypothesis, why all these points being on the line, what it says for prime numbers, because why is it so important? Riemann discovered that if they're on this line, it means that these dice that Gauss was using to choose the primes are actually a fair set of dice. They're distributing the primes fairly throughout the universe of numbers, rather randomly, but at least they're distributed fairly. If the Riemann hypothesis is false and there's a zero off that line, it means those dice are very biased. It's forcing lots of primes in some areas and no primes in others. They're a bit like, primes are a little bit like molecules in a room. We know that we're not quite sure where each molecule is, but we know that they're fairly distributed around the room. There isn't a vacuum in one corner of our studio and a concentration of molecules in another. The Riemann hypothesis, if it's true, will say that the primes are distributed rather like the molecules in this room, rather fairly distributed, but still quite random.
Jackie, how did Alan Turing add to this? He was a contemporary of Hardy's at Cambridge.
Yes, a little bit later. I mean, Turing's another British mathematician. He was interested in logic and computing. This was in the days, of course, before computers. He was interested in computability in a theoretical way, but he also began to build computing machines even before the war that would actually calculate the zeros in the zeta function. This work was interrupted by the war, and Turing went off to Bletchley, where he was one of the people who really played a huge part in code-breaking during the war. After the war, he carried on with his work on the Zeta machine and managed to prove that the first 1,104 zeros do lie on the line. So this was the first real evidence that all of the first few zeros do lie on the line. At that point, his machine broke down and he couldn't go any further, but other people, of course, have built faster and better machines since, and this kind of work has continued. Now, this raises a question. Can you prove the Riemann hypothesis by computer? Not really. All you can do is show that more and more zeros do lie on the line. It doesn't tell you that there isn't going to be one further out somewhere that's off the line.
And as we said before, right. that just messes up the whole thing.
And that would mess
a
up
single
nothing.
One off the line, yeah. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
So just before we go in for the final lap of this, Marcus, can you give us an idea of the listeners who've stayed as I hanging on, many of them, I suspect, by their fingertips, as I am doing, completely intrigued by this outer space thought that you mathematicians go in for, and there's a whole world out there that we talk about rarely, but the awful utilitarian thing comes in. Does this have any use or point in the world of sitting at a table? Or
it's a fair question. And Hardy used to revel in the fact that these primes would have no use at all. I mean, he actually turned out to be completely wrong. These prime numbers are fundamental now to the codes that protect our secrets on the internet. So every time you send your credit card to a shop online, you're using actually the fact that we don't understand the primes well enough in order to keep that credit card secure. In fact, to crack a code on the internet, you have to do the following thing. If I give you a number like 15, you have to give me the two primes which build that number 15. Okay, that's small enough that you can tell me that's 3 times 5. But if I now give you a 200-digit number and say, okay, that's built out of two primes, it's a bit like salt, it's built out of sodium and chlorine, but I'm not telling you what the two primes are, and to crack a code on the internet, basically someone like Amazon has a public e-telephone number, which is a 200-digit number, and to crack any credit card which is being sent to Amazon, you have to break this number into the two primes which built it. Now, you take a computer and you set it looking for those primes, it will take the lifetime of the universe to find them. So it's a bit like trying to build a prime number spectrometer or something. You know, chemists have this spectrometer which will tell you sodium and chlorine build salt. But we don't understand the primes well enough, so we don't have a machine which can crack these codes. So that's why this pure mathematics is actually very relevant to anybody who uses the internet to keep their secrets secure.
Are there any other uses that you can see might come up, Robin?
Not particularly uses, but there's certainly been a very recent link between prime numbers and quantum physics. Perhaps Marcus would like to talk about that, because I'm not really so aware of that.
Well, this is, I think, the most exciting bit, the new bit of the story, which is these primes seem to have nothing to do with physics at all. But an amazing meeting. Most work in a mathematics department gets done over tea when you talk to people. And at tea at Princeton, the Institute for Advanced Study, a mathematician, Hugh Montgomery, was just chatting idly with a physicist, Freeman Dyson, about what he'd been talking about in the number theory seminar. And he spotted a pattern that he found in the way the zeros are laid out on Riemann's critical line. And he seemed to think that the zeros didn't like to be close together. They sort of repelled each other. And when he showed Freeman Dyson this model, Freeman Dyson said, "Oh my God, that's exactly the way that energy levels are laid out in large atoms like uranium and erbium. And they're such special patterns that there couldn't just be a coincidence that the way the zeros are laid out on this line look exactly the same as the sort of spectra that you get in energy levels in large atoms like uranium." So we suddenly realised there had to be a connection between these two. It's a bit like an archaeologist seeing designs in one area in Mexico and then in Egypt, and they're exactly the same. There's got to be some connection between these two cultures. So now we think that the way to understand Riemann's hypothesis is to use the mathematics of quantum physics. This sort of sign that we've been given is telling us that the mathematics of quantum physics might be the maths that should be used to understand why the zeros are on this line.
What if the Riemann hypothesis is not... what if it is proved, Jackie said, and what if it isn't proved?
Well, in one sense, it doesn't matter either way, because either way we'll get some very interesting mathematics out of it. I mean, all the evidence really now is pointing to the fact that it's true, but we never know. It may be false. But if it's false, it'll be false for an interesting reason, and mathematicians will explore those reasons. And this has happened before in mathematics, that something that was thought to be true for a very long time is overturned, and you get a whole new development taking place. This happened in geometry, for instance, in the 19th century, when you suddenly get completely new kinds of geometry that no one had thought of. It would be the same if the Riemann hypothesis wasn't true. If it is true, in proving that it's true, and I think it will be proved eventually if it is true, then that will also lead to new thoughts and new mathematics.
Robin.
I came across a result some years ago which was very interesting. It was some result, I can't remember what it was, but the proof was in two parts. It said, if the Riemann hypothesis is true, then you can deduce this and this and this, and then you can prove the result you want to prove. However, if the Riemann hypothesis is false, then this leads to this and this and this, and you can still get the result that you want. So it was a fascinating result in mathematics where you've proved it, whether the Riemann hypothesis is true or false, but you don't know which it is, and yet you can still prove it.
Well, I think that's a rare sort of
theorem.
There are a lot of mathematicians who have to assume the Riemann hypothesis is true, which implies that the primes are laid out in this beautiful way in order to make progress. I mean, I have two theorems which are depending on the Riemann hypothesis being true. I need to know that I can find primes reasonably often when I'm going through the universe of numbers, and that's what Riemann's hypothesis will tell me. It gives us a good grasp on the way nature laid out these numbers. And I think most of us feel like the subject won't be quite the subject we thought it was if Riemann hypothesis is false. I mean, I think we'd all, it'd be like waking up and finding, there were actually two suns or something like that. You know, the way we view our world is very much the way we think Riemann discovered, and it'll be a big shock for us.
Do you find increasing primes are playing an increasing part in mathematics, Jackie? They're looking for primes. Are they increasingly important?
I think just searching for larger and larger primes isn't particularly important except as a computing exercise. But what I think is interesting is that primes are so very basic, you can explain to a 5 or 6 year old child what a prime number is. And yet through history, they've entailed more and more complex mathematics and brought in ideas that at first sight seem to have nothing to do with primes. So we find they're tied in with complex numbers, with and with the Riemann hypothesis itself, which is hugely difficult to prove. So I think that's very interesting that something so very difficult and deep comes from something so very simple.
Well, thank you for making this listener have an inkling of understanding of something very difficult and deep. And thank you very much to Robin Wilson, Jackie Stedall and Marcus Jusotoy. Next week's programme will be about relativism, the philosophical school of thought that challenged the notion of absolute truth. Thanks for listening.